Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, February 6th, the Triple Package, Triple Axel Edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, recording from the Washington, D.C. studio. I am joined in New York today by the lovely June Thomas. Oh my God, I sound like Steve Metcalf. By the lovely June Thomas.
Hello, Hannah.
I don't know what you're wearing because I'm not there.
Purple. Sorry. Beautiful purple sweater.
And there's Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
So before we get going today, I want to announce again our live show, our special love show at 6th and I in Washington, D.C. We are joined by special guests from the Date Lab, my favorite Washington Post column, which sets up uptight Washingtonians with each other and then has them rate the results. You can get tickets at slate.com/XXDC. There are still tickets available, and we would love to see you there. So please come. It's going to be a really, really fun show. We did it last year, and it was really fun, and it will be again. Our three topics. First, Dylan Farrow, the adopted daughter of Woody Allen, writes an open letter in the New York Times detailing exactly how her father abused her. Can we ever watch a Woody Allen movie again? Second, Tiger Mother, Amy Chua strikes again with a new book explaining why certain cultural groups succeed more than others. And third, the Olympics are coming this week, a sports forum where women can shine as much as men. Because really, who wants to watch men do 10,000 ski jumps? We will preview the women of the Olympics. So our first topic, a depressing one. Since Woody Allen won the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Golden Globes Awards last month, stories about his unsavory personal life have flared up again. The worst of them are accusations that he molested his 7-year-old adopted daughter, Dylan. These accusations have been fought about for years, and then last week, Dylan herself wrote an open letter in the New York Times detailing those allegations. Alarmingly, some people were immediately dismissive of her, and other people were not, including Jessica Winter, who is joining us today on our segment. Hi, Jessica. She's an editor at Slate, and she has written about this several times. Hello.
Hi, Hannah. Hi, June. Hi, Noreen.
Hey. Hello.
So before we begin the segment, I do want to say that Woody Allen was never convicted of any crime, although in his custody battle with Mia Farrow, a New York appellate court confirmed her version of events. And now a new addition to the pile of evidence, which is Dylan's open letter. So, Jessica, how does Dylan's open letter change the debate that we've been having about this for a while?
I think what changes now is that Dylan's story has always been mediated in some way. It has filtered up to the general public through court documents and tabloid reports and news reports, and she's always been almost this kind of abstracted figure, whereas Woody Allen, Mia Farrow are very much flesh and blood characters who have been in the public eye for 40, 50 years even. Other people have spoken on her behalf. Her brother Ronan Farrow and her mother Mia Farrow have spoken out in support of her after the Golden Globe ceremony that feted Woody Allen. And even in the November issue of Vanity Fair, when she spoke for the first time on the record to a reporter about her memories of being abused by her father, it was still a case of a journalist, Marie North, you know, taking a transcript, cutting the parts out of it that fit the shape and frame of a larger story that she was writing about Mia Farrow and her family. The New York Times piece is completely different because it's a first-person direct address under Dylan Farrow's byline, under Dylan Farrow's picture, where she literally stares out at us from the page, giving her account as a full-grown woman with agency who is exerting authority over her own story and her own memories and taking charge of her part of the narrative. And it's very powerful.
Now, in that letter, she describes a pretty specific scene of where she is, how she's looking at a train set, what Woody Allen does and says to her, not just a singular incident, but things that he asked her to do throughout her childhood, namely, you know, get under the sheets with him when he was wearing very little clothing, stick his thumb in her mouth. Now, how many of those specifics have been known already? How many of them were already out on the record and well known?
A lot of these details were in the two Maureen Orth stories that appeared in Vanity Fair, one in 1992 when the whole scandal was blowing up, and again in the November issue. And a lot of this has been raked over in the custody battle that raged between Farrow and Allen throughout the mid-90s. So a lot of the details aren't actually new. What is new is that it's Dylan who's speaking to us.
Now, I have to say, I was affected. I felt that one thing that had changed is that she, you know, there's always been this question of Woody Allen as a living figure. You know, there's a lot of debate about how we should feel about his movies, which we can talk about a little bit. But she was sort of calling us in on she was holding us accountable, basically, because she's telling us that she as an individual person is affected every time there are accolades showered upon Woody Allen. I mean, that's what changed for me, I have to say, is that it became, like you said, much less of an abstract question and more of something that we actually had to realize that there was a live victim at the center of this abstract debate we've been having.
And she called out Hollywood actors and actresses by name, you know, people who had worked with him, in particular Diane Keaton, who gave the speech about Woody Allen at the Golden Globe. She said, "You knew me when I was a child. Have you forgotten me?" Which was really cut to the heart of the matter.
Yeah, it also made me realize why the Golden Globe Award was a problem as opposed to just liking one of his movies. And I think the Culture Fest did mention this, right? But you know, the idea that you are awarding a person, like a whole person, it's quite different. Like their life, their personhood, you can't really ignore that. It's hard to imagine Roman Polanski getting such an award. You know, I don't know why Woody Allen comes clean. And so it seems to me that would be the appropriate moment when she would come forward.
It's kind of interesting too, though, because Woody Allen is a very peculiar kind of, for somebody who's so famous and has been in such a public eye for a long time, he very rarely, you know, he doesn't show up at events famously. He was watching a play when the Golden Globes was giving out his Lifetime Achievement Award. You know, he just went to the Oscars that one time in 2011, or rather shortly after 9/11. He's a guy who is kind of there but not there. You see him, but he doesn't really speak except through his characters and his kind of proxy characters. So he's a particularly odd person to give a Lifetime Achievement Award to as a figure, because it's such a weird version of a figure.
Well, but he makes a movie every year.
He does.
And it's a Woody Allen movie, and everyone goes to see it.
Yep. Absolutely.
Are you guys still going to go see Woody Allen movies after this?
The artistic debate has not been that hard for me, I have to say, because ever since I was a young child living in New York, and I am, you know, and I'm a target audience. I'm, you know, neurotic like he is, like I'm Jewish like he is. I really should be the kind of person who likes Woody Allen movies. I found them to be utterly creepy on this specific charge of his relationship to women. So it always made no sense to me, even as a teenager, how someone with so much self-awareness and so much introspection could not see clearly what was wrong with his portrayal of himself as attractive to women. Like, immediately that struck me as wrong and a great hole in his artistic vision. And so I always could not stand Woody Allen movies for that reason, even though some of them I recognize to be incredibly interesting, like Crimes and Misdemeanors and, you know, Manhattan. And, you know, I understand what's charming about them, but that I could never get over that even early on. And so, in fact, to me, there isn't this disjuncture between what I'm learning now and the Woody Allen I've sort of known and loved all my life. It's all of a piece. So it's actually not that hard for me.
Yeah, Manhattan in particular, I think that might have been the first Woody Allen movie I saw, even before Annie Hall. And the first time I saw it, I was like, well, that was a great first half of the movie. I hate how that ends with the 17-year-old girl. That's terrible. And now it's just even more terrible when you...
And I think that kind of myopia is visible in the interviews that he has given over the years. If you look back to the 60 Minutes segment that he did with Steve Croft in, I think, either 92 or 93, if you look back at the Time magazine cover story, the interview that he did with Walter Isaacson in August of 1992... This is a guy who really doesn't comprehend why his sexual relationship with his longtime partner's 19-year-old daughter, Suni Previn, who was the older sister of his own three children, why that should be a problem, why anyone would sort of look askance at that. He really can't comprehend it. Or maybe he does and doesn't want to admit it or something. But that was another thing that always seemed really odd about him to me, that you know, first of all, that he engaged in such a relationship, but also that he just didn't get what the big fuss was. I'm not a fan of Woody Allen's movies either, so this is not a kind of quandary for me as a moviegoer. But what I think this changes the calculus a little bit for Woody Allen fans who have said over and over and over again, well, we don't really know. He wasn't charged with a crime. He wasn't convicted of a crime. Presumption of innocence is a sacred tenet of our justice system and of our American society. But Aaron Beatty in The New Inquiry wrote a brilliant piece about this very question, where he says, once you've heard Dylan Farrow's words, once you've seen her speaking for herself, to presume Woody Allen's innocence is to presume her guilt, in that you're assuming that she's lying. Or it means that you're presuming Mia Farrow's guilt in having coached this child into making up this story, which she has stuck to all of these years. And those two scenarios, to me, if I'm going to feel any solidarity with victims of sexual abuse or just of women and mothers in general, that is a much more uncomfortable prospect for me than presuming Woody Allen's innocence in all things, particularly given the fact that he actually fared miserably in courts of law in terms of the custody battle. In the custody battle, he was not allowed unsupervised visitation with his son, and he was never allowed any visitation of any kind with Dylan. So, no, he was never charged with a crime, but he was also not allowed to spend time with his children. And that was, you know, those were legal decisions based on stacks of evidence and testimony. So the short answer to your question is no, I don't watch Woody Allen movies and I don't really care, and it's not a problem.
So I'm glad you went back to that, because I feel like we didn't quite conclusively, we didn't settle on what should be our proper pose towards this as a legal matter. Like, it's not quite neutrality, right? We're not arguing for neutrality here. Like, we have evidence on one side, evidence on the other side. Like, it's not like you're just trying to move us from the presumption of his guilt to just being neutral. Like, there, you're saying there's actually, you know, even though there's no conviction, that there's enough sort of suspicion and evidence that we should weigh.
I guess I'm asking why, in the wake of Dylan Farrow's letter, and I'm interested to hear from the three of you about this, why there is so much energy expended on social media to doubt her.
Because
why that's the default, rather than the default being, hey, you know, it really sounds like there's something to this.
Well, I think a lot of people just identify so strongly with Woody Allen, and they, you know, they see his neuroses as their neuroses. They're, you know, he's expressing things they cannot express. And so then it becomes clear that, whoa, his neuroses, perhaps, allegedly, are really, really not inside the norm, right? Like, the jokes that he's consistently made, you go back and look, the jokes he's consistently made about child molestation throughout his career, in both his work and in interviews, like, those aren't jokes. Maybe those are coming from, like, a really, really dark place inside of him. And yes, that's part of, like, Woody Allen's humor, is that he mixes up the really dark and the really comic. And then for people who have built their own cultural identity around, you know, Woody Allen's my guy, Woody Allen gets me, Woody Allen is me in some way, they just perhaps do not want to confront the fact that he is, well, I mean, he's a complicated guy, right? Everyone always knew that, but, like, that there might be something much, much, much darker. That's something really hard to deal with.
It's been interesting to me to see some of the response has been, why are you bringing up this 20-year-old case? And to me, that's just like, why the heck not? I mean,
well, it's because of the Golden Globes giving him a Lifetime Achievement Award.
I mean, that is the reason, but then, that wasn't enough. I mean, that didn't necessarily signify that it would. And I think it's, to me, this is a case that's getting attention. It's standing in some ways for the problems of accusing people of horrible crimes and, you know, sticking up for people's right to go unmolested. You know, Dylan had this line in her open letter that said, Woody Allen is a living testament to the way our society fails the survivors of sexual assault and abuse. Now, clearly, she's not a typical alleged victim. He's not a typical alleged assailant. But just the fact that even in such a very high-profile case, so many people had either forgotten or didn't know. We've heard at Slate that we know that the people we work with are crazy knowledgeable about everything. Several of them who are in their 20s, who I'm sure have seen many of his films, didn't know about this. And yeah. So in a sense, that is, to me, interesting that even a really hugely high-profile case like this can kind of be forgotten. That, you know, 20 years ago, there was, I remember, debating whether to see Woody Allen movies. And then it kind of fades away. And it fades away for ordinary people, too. But even in a case like this where there's so many people with such strong feelings. I mean, Jessica, you did a fantastic riposte to a piece in The Daily Beast, which, you know, by essentially a huge Woody Allen fanboy, which was just a gross, gross article in many ways. But it also is in some ways kind of typical of the kind of feelings that you described, Noreen, of like there's this strong affiliation with him that's odd.
I also think there's this psychological trick where people mistake self-awareness for lack of crime. And so, like, if you know yourself that well, then you wouldn't continually stray into these blind spots, you know, but you do. Apparently you do.
And there's a lot of self-loathing in his comedy, which maybe isn't so funny always.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jessica, for joining us for this segment.
Thank you.
Now let's move on to our second topic. Amy Chua, better known as the Tiger Mother, who taught us a few years back that we were being too soft on our children, is now back with something else to teach us. She and her husband, law professor Jed Rubenfeld, have written a book called The Triple Package, explaining, I can't say the triple package, I'm telling you, David and I have a lot of triple package jokes. Anyway, I am a grown-up. Explaining why certain cultural groups in America are more successful than others. Basically, it's a combination of three factors, a superiority complex, an inferiority complex, and the old marshmallow test, impulse control. Is this racial determinism? Is it interesting? And aren't I glad that I'm Jewish? So you, June and Noreen, I'm sorry to say that the Brits and the Irish don't really feature as among the great triple package winners. Nonetheless, I will accept you as my intellectual sparring partners. Noreen, what did you think of her theory about the triple package? Did it convince you that this was a recipe for success? What did you take it as?
Well, if you take the three traits on their own, it makes a lot of sense. It also, she's repackaging something sort of old. I mean, what she's describing is, in fact, discipline, ambition, and confidence, right? Like, right. She's not the first person to intuit that those things will lead you to success in life. What she's saying that's new, of course, is that certain cultures have this baked into their value system more than others do. And the possibly most controversial part of what she's saying is that once groups have been in America for a long time, they lose the value system that got them there, and then they just become regular old Americans. So the argument she's making essentially isn't necessarily a racial one, because she's not saying it has, you know, it has to do with like the part of the world you're from. It's just, you know, the way that your family is acculturated, and that can change. But you know, I sort of think what she's doing here is capitalizing on her name and her image as someone who has, you know, figured out a way to stoke the anxieties of Americans in a very particular way with respect to China, which is where, you know, she's identified as a tiger mother. And she's made that her own brand. And now she's sort of wrapping up this old insight in this new branding.
I mean, it seems to me that, yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's a whole bunch of truisms. And I have to say, I haven't read the book. I mean, whenever I've seen a couple of their appearances, like on the Today Show, and, you know, they keep claiming, well, we've got all of these stats and we've got all of these, they've done all these regressions, which I haven't seen. So I'm speaking from, you know, reading some excerpts, reading some interviews. But with that proviso, what it seems to me this book is saying is that new immigrant groups are different than, you know, people who've been here a long time. And that, just except for Jews and Mormons, who apparently, you know, which, let's face it, as well as being cultural groups, are religious groups, and so maybe there's, you know, that's another factor. But for the rest of the groups that she's talking about, I mean, the immigrant experience is very different to, you know, having grown up here with your parents not being without ties, alone, you know, relying on their group, really being focused on their making good in this new world. And that just seems to me, you can't really fake being an immigrant and, you know, having all of that stuff riding on you.
Bingo, that's exactly what I think. See, I think she's describing, it's a kind of mildly interesting anthropology of an immigrant experience,
right.
Effectively, an immigrant experience. I had, you know, my parents are immigrants, and we were all striving in our little immigrant ghetto in Queens, you know, and an immigrant experience that lots of people have. And as such, it's kind of interesting to think of it as superiority matched with inferiority. I never quite put those two together. And I like that as a description of what drives immigrants forward. But it is not a recipe for success. You know, people keep calling it a Gladwellian book, like this is going to be, you know, so businessmen are going to be eagerly reading this and saying, like, how can I be superior and inferior at this meeting? Like, it's just a very particular ethnic anthropology, and it doesn't have broad application. So that's one funny thing about this book. Secondly, her husband, if you read the profile in the New York Times magazine, which I thought was really quite good.
Agree.
He is the disproof of their entire thesis. So basically what happens is you have this first-generation immigrant experience, which is particular, and then you either cement your privilege or you don't. And then once you cement your privilege, everything that she's saying is completely irrelevant, because Jed Rubenfeld is the child of, you know, Jewish parents who have already given up on all of this stuff and are like, go, honey, you know, be a philosopher, do whatever you want to do. And he doesn't have any of this kind of drive that she's talking about in the way that he was raised. Nonetheless, he's extremely successful, because by that point, you're the established class, right? So she truly does not grapple with, you know, privilege and lack of privilege and how those factors. She does in these kind of, you know, embarrassed asides, like, no, we're not saying that, you know, people from Appalachia or African Americans are worse than we are. We're really not saying that. But, you know, and that's the third problem with the book, is that it does not have the courage of its convictions. Like, it makes me look back at the Tiger Mom book and realize that Amy Chua is a person trying to have it always. Like, we think she's this crazy tiger mother, like, you know, this kind of cuckoo Chinese mom, you know, whipping her kids into shape. But she's not at all. She's like part that, and also part lives in this kind of gentle little enclave, liberal enclave in Yale, you know, as this great scene with her daughter in the New York Times Magazine piece where she tells her daughter, like, don't you have to email your teacher because blah, 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 blah. And the daughter says, she knows I'm sick, mom. And the daughter rolls her eyes, and then Amy Chua just walks away, right? So, like, if this book had the courage of its convictions, like, you know, the Charles Murray book about intelligence and IQ, it would actually say these people are failing because, right? But she doesn't say that because she doesn't want to get in trouble.
Well, and back to the question of class, there was a great article in Time sort of picking apart this thesis. And one of the points the author makes is that several of the groups she cites, you know, like Nigerians, for instance, the people who emigrate from Nigeria tend to be already wealthy. And just anecdotally, I feel like every person I've ever met, you know, in college or whatever, who was a Nigerian immigrant, their parents turned out to be like crazily wealthy. And, you know, you do have a leg up if your parents have a lot of money, no matter where you're from.
Or if your parents went to college. I mean, I remember endorsing a few weeks ago this book called Hunting Season, which is about attacks on Ecuadorian immigrants in Patchogue, Long Island. But one of the chapters talks about the kind of people who emigrate. Now, these were poor guys from Ecuador. They didn't have education, they crossed illegally. However, there's a particular type of person who leaves. It's not the very bottom. It's not the people who have privilege necessarily. I mean, they're in Nigeria, it's a little different because there's a great educational system, but nothing to do. So that's a slightly different profile. But the kind of people who come are, again, pre-programmed to have this kind of, you know, the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, the impulse control. I mean, that's who emigrates. And so it's not even just a matter of groups. It's a matter of those people who take this huge step, which we shouldn't underestimate what it takes to emigrate. One of the things that is guaranteed to make me crazy is when, you know, something happens in America, people are like, I'm moving to Canada. Like, first of all, it's just so simple. Second of all, you'd last a month. I mean, it's not easy to emigrate. It's a big thing, and it takes a very specific kind of person. And so when they arrive, their kids are, you know, they're going to make sure that they take full advantage. Third generation, maybe not so much fourth generation, forget it. That's all been forgotten. This is just a process. It's like, it's the circle of life. It's the circle of America.
My least favorite song, The Circle of Life, it is actually my least favorite song in the world. The other problem is that what these guys are describing is much less true now than it was 15 years ago. So my own personal story, when my family moved to America and my father was a cab driver, he still is, or he just retired, but he owned his own medallion. You know, it was very – being a striving immigrant was something you could do with a reasonable amount of success and an expectation that you would at least like touch middle class, right? Mm-hmm. That's the way we all lived in my immigrant ghetto. It's just not true anymore. Right. Like if you're a guy who comes to be a cab driver now, you are working like slave labor, right? You're working for a bigger company. You're making, you know, slave wages working half days. You're competing with Uber. It's just a different world than it was when this little, you know, this little package she described would propel you forward. It's really hard. I mean, this is Obama's whole point about the American dream and how difficult it is to access for so many people these days. That's really, really true. You know, it's the minimum wage problem. It's the lack of jobs problem. It's just, you know, it can't be like the grit will push you forward.
And yet there, it is really striking. There's one thing again that I just saw in one of these pieces in The New York Times, the numbers for Stuyvesant High School, which is, I believe, your alma mater.
Woohoo!
And it's a very selective public school, which you just get into by taking an exam, right?
Yes.
And in the most recent class, according to the Tiger couple, there were 9 blacks, 24 Hispanics, 177 whites, and 620 Asians. Now, that is still striking. And for all that I want to call BS on this book and these notions, that is really striking.
But that's very, you know, it's so funny because I was thinking about Stuyvesant, too. She discounts education, right? Like, so she says it's not education that's so important. It's these other things. Or is what she's saying that it's because these, you know, Chinese parents, you know, even if they don't have any money, they will spend their last penny for their children to take the Stuyvesant prep test. Is that her point? So it doesn't so much matter that IQ or they're smart or they value education. It's just, no, it is that they value education, right?
Yeah.
It's the latter that they value education.
Yeah.
It is really striking. It was looking like that a little bit when I was a kid, but it was, you know, it was sort of like a war between the Jews and the Asians when I went to Stuyvesant. Now the Jews have totally lost.
Now I'm going to be going around. Amy Chua, I want you to break it down. Give me the, you know, let's break it down into your groups. Tell me how many Mormons were there. Tell me how many Nigerians. I just want you to break everything down because it's totally cool. It's totally cool to do that because it's just about cultural traits. So just kind of give me the numbers broken down by that and then I will just explode into a pool of no.
Well, that part, I have to say, that part of the book is really fun because, you know, we're really generally not allowed to talk that way unless we're Amy Chua. So there'll be a chapter about how Jews really do control the world.
And then, you know,
we're not saying Jews control the world, but they do. And then it's just like a listing of numbers of, you know, percentage of Forbes, Forbes, you know, CEOs who are Jewish and Hollywood, who's Jewish.
Nobel Prize winners.
Who's Jewish, household income, Jews are rich. You know, it's this hilarious chapter about Jews and then the Mormons, then throw in some Nigerians. And you know, it's like, really, we just don't talk that way anymore. So that part is pleasurable to read. So let's move on to our final topic, women in the Olympics. It's about damn time. That's what Jessica Jerome's mother, who I've loved watching, Barbara, said about her daughter being the first woman to compete as a ski jumper. There's all sorts of interesting women. I have to say, when we first decided on this topic, I wasn't that sure how to approach it. But every time I think about women in the Olympics, I just love looking at their pictures, you know? And the thing that I really love about it is it's like the tough broads versus the delicate broads, you know? So you have these awesome ski jumping ladies, you know, like the Sarah Hendrickson Washington, who looks just like Rashida Jones, doesn't she? And then there's Lindsay Vann, who I kept thinking was a typo of Lindsay Vonn, but is a completely different person. And then, you know, you skip over to the ski fawns. You know, I mean, the skating fawns, like Goldie Grace.
But they're tough,
Gracie
too.
Gracie
Gold. We were joking before the segment began that that's like, you know, how people have porn star names. That's the perfect figure skater name, Gracie Gold. Like, she's so sweet that she gets the gold.
No, but come on. There is, the overlap between porn star and figure skating. There is that way in which there's this kind of unstated sexy that they're supposed to do, but not really, you know? So, like, you can't really bare your belly, so instead you just have, like, a flesh-toned costume. I mean, it's the way that sort of figure skating engages with nubile sexuality is creepy every time.
It sure is, because also they have to smile, mm-hmm. but they can't really look too... They're supposed to look wholesome rather than sexy. Like, it's a very specific niche that they're going for. It's very interesting.
It's still so Cold War figure skating. Yeah. I kind of love it. They're like these... Everyone wears these costumes that strike me as very Russian fashion, even to Americans, you know? It's like, what are we doing?
Now, of course, so I looked at lots and lots of photo galleries, and one was of this viral one of the Russians. They're, are they? They're not bobsled. She's not a bobsledder.
All of their female athletes appeared to me in this photo gallery, really. Wearing not
Siberian board Tatiana. Of course, her name is Tatiana. Oh, she is a short track speed skater, and she's naked. And now I know what her nipples look like because she's Russian. It's like what we do to the women in the Olympics. It's just amazing. It's either, if it's not, you know, it makes Sports Illustrated look innocent, like what the Russians do with their female athletes.
Although, I mean, the whole thing about the Olympics, though, I love the Olympics, but I one of the reasons that I love them is that the women really do get to be a really big part of the discussion. It's kind of annoying in a way because NBC, especially in the US, you know, does all of these stories about, you know, human interest and who in their family has had cancer and all of that. But I have to admit that we do kind of need them with these winter athletes, especially because, I mean, I do pay attention and I know about four of these people. You know, you don't come to this sporting event with much expertise. You can kind of come in, you spend 2 weeks absolutely obsessed with it, you know, where you're spending 60 hours solid just watching curling, and then you kind of forget about it for 4 years if you're most people. But for those 2 weeks, it's kind of everything. And I love that.
Well, I'm also kind of moved by the women soaring in the air, like these tough broads like Lindsay Vonn. They're always getting these tough broad injuries, you know, and they're flying through the air. And, you know, especially like the snowboarder Slamy. I mean, that's who you want to be in life. You want to be a lady snowboarder. They are just so cool.
You know, I mean, it is cool. But I have to say, one of the things that does freak me out about the Winter Olympics is how dangerous almost every event is. I mean, skating too. I mean, the pairs, my God, it's like, you know, of course that is one of the reasons that it's so exciting and fun to watch is that, you know, they could crack their head open any second, literally.
It's like a really delicate NASCAR.
Exactly. It really is. And, I mean, there are terrible injuries. And, you know, so many of the people that should be watching, it's not only Lindsay Vonn is out. There are other, you know, people who were expected to be the big stars who probably, you know, many, many posters of them had already been made, who had these terrible injuries. And it's sincerely, seriously dangerous stuff that a lot of them are doing.
How much do you think Lindsay Vonn is still going to be promoted? Like, I she'll still be everywhere. I just on Twitter, I saw the Us Weekly's doing a Special Olympics thing, and like Lindsay Vonn's on the cover because she is beautiful and blonde and dates Tiger Woods.
Right.
And America knows who she is.
Exactly.
And they don't have backups other than Gracie Gold.
Exactly. Who, I mean, I feel really bad for people like Gracie Gold because, you know, there's all this. Of course, if you're going to put someone on the cover, you're not going to say she ain't going to win people. But like, she's not really that expected to medal, and yet we're kind of pushing this kid as someone. Then again, maybe she, you know, it seems like she has those three traits that the Tiger couple says will, you know, lead to success. So there you go.
She's quite tall for a figure skater, too. Did you guys see that? She's 5'6", which I believe is a tall figure skater.
Wow.
See, I feel that over the years, our heart is moving. Maybe this is just my, you know, my hopeful feminism here. But from the figure skaters to the skiing women, that we are just moving towards the tough ones more. Like, it's been a while since we had a, you know, Mary Lou Retton, maybe Tonya Harding kind of tarnished the innocence of the figure skater for us. But the imagery is becoming a little more harder for us to handle. Like, I remember when Lindsay Vonn did her Sports Illustrated sexy thing last time around. You know, when you first looked at it, you thought, oh, this is outrageous. You know, I can't believe that, you know, a woman makes it this far and trains this hard, and how we digest her is by putting her in a swimsuit. It's annoying, you know. On the other hand, it's a more mature form of sexuality than this weird thing that the figure skaters are always going for. So it seemed a little more kind of fully processed, you know, grown up adult woman.
It's interesting, too, you know, at least three members of the bobsled are, you know, it's, as is typical in bobsled, it's typical to kind of take track and field athletes and you know, transfer those skills into pushing the bobsled. But Lolo Jones, who was, you know, the famous virgin of the last Olympics, is now on the bobsled team. And she's put on, I think, like at least 40, maybe 60 pounds, because you do need more strength to push that dang thing. And that's interesting, too. You know, there have been several, I mean, not that many, but several cases of people who've played in both Winter and Summer Olympics. There's famous Canadians, skaters and bicyclists, and also somebody who was on the Canadian hockey team and was on the softball team. I mean, I love those stories of the, you know, the dual Olympians. That to me is like, okay, they're just really good athletes who really want to take part. And that just strikes me as particularly awesome.
Well, and you'll get to see how, because Lolo Jones was sort of sexualized in the last Olympics,
Absolutely.
Right? Like, and it's a little bit harder to sexualize someone in a bobsled suit, right? Yeah. Like, just in general, like snowsuits. It's hard to make that sexy, but people are doing it.
Also, the helmet. I mean, the skaters are one of the few winter athletes who don't perform in a helmet, and that really does make a difference.
So I wonder if, like, part of the joy of the Olympics, even if you're not, you know, sort of ogling, you're not ogling them sexually, but you're ogling the beauty of an athlete's body, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it is just beautiful to watch someone in peak condition perform at a top level, and you really can see that better in many of the summer sports and, frankly, in figure skating, because you just like can see their limbs. And a lot of, you know, the winter sports involve these weird apparatuses and they're just like slaloming down, and you sort of see them coming around a corner and they show how fast it's going and you're like, wow, that's dangerous. But you don't really marvel at the muscles and the coordination in quite the same way as you do with the Summer Olympics. And I wonder if that has something to do with why people just aren't as into the Winter Olympics, myself included.
You know, that was one of the arguments made in justification of Lindsey Vonn's swimsuit issue last time around, was that they were at a distinct disadvantage, both as compared to the figure skaters, but the Summer Olympians, because all you could see was the tiny slit of their eyes. And so it would be very hard for us to connect with such a person and make such a person an American star. So in order to do that, you know, we had to show some skin. I don't know if that's convincing, but it's an interesting argument.
It's odd, too, though, that there's so many. I mean, another reason I think that we have this distance is that even though Olympics are always adding events, you know, it happens in the Summer Olympics, in the Winter Olympics, it feels like in the last, I don't know, 8-12 years, it's become much more X Gamesy.
What do you mean by that?
So many of the, there's a whole lot more of these, for example, snowboarding things that are like the slope style, half pipe. So many of the competitions are just things that they originated in the X Games, in this sort of, which started as a kind of, these are more dangerous, more different, more like kind of millennial type sports. And there's just not a long, if you don't watch the X Games, which I've never done, you don't really have that kind of, you know, I've been watching the Olympics since I was a kid. To me, it's almost like Christmas, in that part of the enjoyment is remembering what you were doing 4 years ago or 8 years ago. Oh, man, do you remember that whole Tonya Harding thing? And that kind of comes to mind when they take to the ice. And whereas, like, with this X Games stuff, you know, I don't really have particularly strong memories of moguls skiing when I was a kid. You know, like, it's basically, going really fast on bumpy snow, which, yeah, no, I couldn't do, not in a million years, but it is kind of a weird sporting event.
Plus, nothing at the Olympics can ever, ever, ever top Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding. Just the high watermark for everything.
Everything. You remember? Sometimes I remember, like, I have such a hard time tying my shoelaces sometimes. Do you remember, like, when Tonya, like, had to pause things because her skate came undone? Like, how perfect was that? So amazing.
She was awesome. I kind of loved Tonya Harding.
Why don't we have that kind of drama anymore? What happened? Have people just become more disciplined in that Amy Chua way? Is it like we just don't have any, you know, out-of-control murderous characters around?
Gosh, I don't really know what the right answer to that question is.
We haven't seen Gracie Gold in action yet, guys.
Right. And so that was my whole, you know, just because of the way my mind works, all I was doing was trying to find darkness in Gracie Gold. Like, because I was like, oh, she has a twin. Ooh, they must hate each other. Oh, boy. All right. Well, we hope you all watch. Last question will be for you, June. So what is your favorite Winter Olympic sport? What should we be most excited about?
I love curling. I mean, I do like the skating. I like ski jumping, which now for the first time in this Olympics will finally have women competitors. But I love curling. It's every single Olympic Games. I get so into it. You know, I start talking, using curling lingo in normal speech. Right now, I like can't even remember it because it's been 4 years. But, you know, I'll be talking about the house and the rock and the nice rock or something. Like when the next time we record, like I'll just be throwing out the curling lingo like a mofo.
No problem. I'll just keep up with you right there. I'll be right there with you. Okay, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
I listened to and really enjoyed the new album from Sharon Jones, who is a sort of neo soul singer who just literally came back from cancer. I mean, she had chemo like a month ago, and she's already on the road touring. And I hope that her recovery continues to go well. But the album is called Give the People What They Want by Sharon Jones, and it's just really fun.
Sounds great. I haven't heard it yet. I am going to recommend a movie which I watched a couple of weeks ago called Fill the Void. It's quite well-known Israeli movie, and it tells the usual story of a woman in an Orthodox family in a complicated situation where she has to choose between marrying someone she doesn't think she loves and, you know, it's like family duty versus your heart kind of dilemma. And yet it is just fabulous. Like, it's so beautifully told and the characters are so surprising and original. And the final scene is one of my favorite final scenes ever. You know, it's got that graduate ending, that kind of mysterious what is that look on her face ending, which is just so great. So I recommend you all see it. June.
Well, I have to say this is going to seem maybe weird, but as I was reading Dylan Farrow's open letter where she talks about what Woody Allen did to her in the attic of their house, I could not help thinking about a Dori Previn song called With My Daddy in the Attic, which kind of touches on a lot of these themes. And of course, Dori Previn was married to Andre Previn, and he left her for Mia Farrow, and she wrote a song called Beware of Young Girls that people often cite. But the album that I believe both of those songs are on is called On My Way to Where. I actually was a huge fan of hers when I was in high school. Then I didn't listen to her songs for years. And I always think that the greatest testament to something that you really loved or that is really good is that even though I hadn't heard her songs for like 30 years, I could totally sing along when I heard them again. And I think that she's just an amazing songwriter who kind of was forgotten, and she just died about this time last year, actually. So I think anything by Dori Previn is worth listening to, but it's especially spooky to listen to the album On My Way to Where.
That's so interesting because I've started to watch Woody Allen movies again just with all this knowledge in mind. Mm. And so it's so interesting to go back, you know, when you have these live toxic figures and listen to the music and see the movies and see how they affect you differently in retrospect. Well, thank you both so much. I want to remind our listeners again about our live show at 6th and I in Washington, D.C. You can get tickets at slate.com/XXDC. I want to thank Chris Wade for recording this podcast, our own June Thomas for engineering the podcast. I also want to thank Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. And we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.